Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegatoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Edwin J. Vieira, Kathleen Shannon, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Leibovitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2828BH Philomath on 104.3, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Chris Gow.
And I'm John G. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On June 4th, the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC, released its annual report, The Year in Hate and Extremism 2023. They describe it as a comprehensive analysis of the groups and organizational infrastructure upholding white supremacy in the United States. For Oregon, in 2023, the SPLC tracked 23 hate and anti-government groups in the state. That's a slight decrease from 2022, but overall a pretty big uptick in the past few years. Just 5 years ago, they tracked 15 hate groups in Oregon. In Washington, the group found 41 hate and anti-government groups last year. Some of the researchers behind the work discussed their findings, the trends, and what they mean for the country and the upcoming election in a press call. Here are some excerpts from what they described.
Questions recording and interview in progress. Requests, please contact press@splcenter.org, and we'll drop that in the chat during this session. Now, without further ado, it is my honor to introduce Margaret Wong, President and CEO of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Margaret.
For decades, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking, exposing, and countering hate and anti-government extremism in the United States. Taking on the most hateful factions in our country is critical to our mission of dismantling white supremacy, advancing the civil and human rights of all people, and defending our democracy. The Year in Hate and Extremism report has long been integral to that work. We've published the report every year since 1990. To our knowledge, it is one of the longest studies of the far right in the world. It provides a comprehensive analysis of the groups and the organizational infrastructure that is upholding white supremacy in the United States. What we're seeing now should be a wake-up call for all of us. Our 2023 report documented more hate and anti-government extremist groups than ever before. With a historic election just months away, these groups are multiplying, mobilizing, and making, and in some cases already implementing, plans to undo democracy. Through rigorous research and analysis, in 2023, we documented 835 active anti-government groups. This is an increase of an alarming 133 groups from 2022. We also documented 595 active hate groups, an increase of 72 organizations. Among these include the highest number of anti-LGBTQ and white nationalist groups we've ever recorded. Extremists and those opposing inclusive democracy spent last year legitimizing insurrection, painting hate as virtuous, and transforming conspiracy theories into mainstream narratives. The danger of this activity will only escalate as we near the election. We must act now to counter disinformation, radicalization, and threats to voters and election workers. You'll hear more from my colleagues about these trends and where we go from here. But let me say this, more than ever, it is imperative that we preserve and strengthen our democracy. And that means preventing anti-democracy forces from dividing us from one another. When extremists attack one community, they're hoping to drive wedges between that group and all others. As our report documents, we're seeing far-right extremist attack drag story hours, Black history in the classroom, synagogues, and mosques. By refusing to accept harassment or threats against any group, and by seeing attacks on one group as an attack on all of us, we build solidarity and we take the necessary steps toward achieving a multiracial, inclusive democracy.
In addition to the increase in hate groups last year, our report documents the effects of these groups that they have on communities. While I'll share some of those details, I want to also emphasize that the report contains multiple examples of resiliency in the face of far-right attacks, things like intimidation and harassment. And it's important to highlight these activities and offer additional opportunities to disrupt the preparations of the far right leading into the 2024 election and beyond. In addition to the record number of white nationalists and anti-LGBTQ groups, we tracked increases in direct actions by these groups, such as anti-Black and anti-Semitic flyering and in-person demonstrations primarily targeting LGBTQ plus people. The nearly 7,000 flyering incidents we documented across the country are a form of direct action designed to intimidate and harass communities of color, stoke fear, and suppress diversity. And the language used in them is often derived from racist and anti-Semitic conspiracies. And anti-Semitic conspiracies seep into mainstream narratives at an alarming pace in 2023, specifically after Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack. The far right blurred the lines between legitimate criticism of the Israeli government's actions and outright anti-Semitism. And the in-person actions we track show a strategy of targeting the very idea of inclusive civil society, a fundamental tenet of our multiracial democracy. Libraries, schools, inclusive religious communities, and hospitals, especially children's hospitals, all experienced the effects of white supremacist and anti-government violence as conspiracy theories about LGBTQ plus and reproductive health care, immigrants, and inclusive education were operationalized by far-right groups and used to fuel these campaigns of intimidation, harassment, and fear. For example, as this slide shows, we tracked nearly 200 incidents targeting community literacy programs featuring drag performers, sometimes called drag story hours. These programs provide public goods, helping people overcome barriers to literacy and building connections that produce thriving, resilient, and democratically engaged communities which respect the diversity inherent to American society. But our report shows fewer things seemed more threatening to the far right in 2023 than these childhood literacy programs and inclusive civil society. We documented bomb threats, groups barricading public library doors, disrupting events, online harassment as just a few of the strategies far right groups used to curb freedoms of expression and assembly and attempt to shut down drag story hours across the country. In addition, far-right groups mobilized around a plan to reshape American society after the 2024 election into a Christian theocracy. This plan was clearly documented by Project 2025, a plan developed and supported by more than 75 organizations, including at least 9 hate and anti-government groups. This includes anti-LGBTQ hate groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, which also had a hand in rolling back access to LGBTQ plus and reproductive healthcare last year. Anti-immigrant groups like the Center for Immigration Studies and anti-government groups like Moms for Liberty. The plan would encode many of the conspiracy theories about LGBTQ plus people and immigrants we saw far-right groups use to mobilize in-person attacks on our inclusive civil society into state and federal law. The plan, for example, would reach into our public schools, private businesses, into our homes and cities, and demand compliance with far-right theology and white supremacist ideologies through the force of law. For example, it equates LGBTQ plus identity and pornography, demands that teachers who follow inclusive lesson plans be listed as sex offenders, and calls for shutting down private companies who distribute information about LGBTQ plus identity. The plan calls for implementing dragnet style raids looking for immigrants, effectively ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and limiting access to contraception and abortion care, among many other far right goals. As our report shows, all of these things were and continue to be points of mobilization for the far right as they prepare not just for the 2024 election, but for what American society will look like in its aftermath. So I'll now turn over the presentation to my colleague, Cassie Miller.
I wanted to go over some of the more notable findings in the report. As some of my colleagues have already mentioned, we found a record number of anti-LGBTQ plus groups this year, but we also found a record number of white nationalist groups. It's the highest we have ever recorded. It's 166 of these groups, which was more than a 50% increase from the year before. And these are groups that specifically seek to build a white ethnostate. And as we emphasize in the report, something notable about the white power movement right now is that although it's very large and it's very mobilized, it really lacks centralized organization. There's no clear central figurehead or figureheads. Instead, the movement is operating as this loose, decentralized network of organizations that are vying for attention from far-right activists and also the media. And in a moment like this, we would expect the numbers of white nationalist groups to maybe go down and for them to be less mobilized. But we're seeing something different. Instead, we've seen a growth in their numbers and a lot of on-the-ground organizing from this movement in particular. And the question is, why is that? And as we point out in one of our essays, a lot of the motivation for the white power movement is now coming from an external source. And that is an increasing hard right movement within the mainstream of American politics. So the white power movement really finds a lot of promise in this political moment because they see so much alignment between their own political goals and that of the mainstream right. It's a movement that is less interested in building a countervailing political apparatus than they would have been in the past, because they don't feel the need to do so. You know, with the emphasis on halting immigration at the southern border, denying rights to LGBTQ people, denying teachers the ability to talk about difficult topics like racism, and eliminating access to abortion, the mainstream right is pursuing a policy agenda that is very much in line with what the white power movement would like to see enacted. And that movement really feels empowered right now. And you can see their confidence not only in the surging numbers of groups, but also in their surging activism. So we found in this year that there were over 140 different demonstrations from the white power movement, and about half of them targeted LGBTQ communities. What we've really seen is that this is a movement that is coalescing around intimidating a particular community of people. And when you see a movement coalesce like that, that means they become less compromising and there's a greater chance of violence. So this is a dangerous situation that we found ourselves in. But a lot of these groups are also focusing kind of broadly on demonstrating their strength and trying to intimidate communities and just promoting white power ideology. As we document in the report, we are also expanding our research into male supremacy. And this is a belief that cisgender men are innately superior to people of other gender and gender identities. It is their right to subjugate women, trans people, non-binary people. Male supremacy goes beyond just misogyny or transphobia because its adherents believe that people who aren't men shouldn't have access to the same rights that men do, and that women and others should be diminished, suppressed, or harmed. And so much like white supremacy, male supremacy kind of forms the foundation of an extremist movement, but it's also very much a part of our everyday social fabric. This year, we've added a number of new male supremacist groups, and most notably, we've added a number of anti-abortion male supremacist groups to our list of hate groups. And we consider these hate groups because they want to deny bodily autonomy to people who can become pregnant and essentially relegate them to second-class citizenship. These are activists who believe that women's autonomy and their ability to control their bodies are things that are contestable. So the groups that we've listed not only want to deny the women the ability to control their reproduction, but also want to punish women for having abortions. We've listed four groups that call themselves abortion abolitionists, meaning that they want to abolish abortion completely without any exceptions, and also that they want our legal system to treat abortion as murder, which would in many cases subject those who terminate their pregnancies to the death penalty. So this is a movement that has gained greater footing within the anti-abortion movement as that movement as a whole becomes more militant after Dobbs. We've seen increased militancy and violence coming from the anti-abortion movement, especially in states that are protective of abortion rights and reproductive rights. But we've also seen states introduce abolitionist bills, which would treat abortion as murder. These are predominantly concentrated in the South. So with that, I will pass it to my colleague, Joe Winnikulaitin.
Thank you so much, Cassie. I appreciate it. And thank you for everyone for being here, both at SPLC and our guests. Since our beginning of a monitoring, Margaret has already mentioned that we've had this long, decades-long research into extremists in the far right. And since the beginning of this monitoring, SPLC has tracked the ways also in which religion affects extremism and how extremism affects religion. And a lot of times in our culture, we look at extremist orgs and kind of assume that they're secular. There has been a theology that has motivated and continues to motivate a good deal of the anti-government world and has for decades now. This is known as dominionism. And according to a researcher at one of our colleague organizations, Frederick Clarkson, dominionism is a theocratic idea that Christians, and usually a small subset of Christians, are called to take control of the institutions and levers of all society, from the family to government. It really is a form of religious supremacy over all areas and aspects of our culture. And over the last several years, we and colleague organizations have noted a distinct rise in dominionism, which has become a major force in the ongoing movement of extremism from the fringes to the mainstream, which we've been cataloging and monitoring for several years now. The essay in Year in Hate focuses on the latest dominionist movement, which has become a major threat to a meaningful democracy focused on human and civil rights and liberties. I'm referring here to what's been called the New Apostolic Reformation, or for short, the NAR. This is a new and powerful religious supremacy movement that is attempting to transform culture and politics in the U.S., as well as countries across the world, into a grim authoritarianism. At the heart of the NAR's political project is what's called the Seven Mountain Mandate, and it was a term coined by one of the leaders of the NAR, Prophet Lance Wallnau. The Seven Mountains is a friendlier face to dominionism than we've seen in the past, that still envisions society as seven mountains that must be conquered and ruled. And these mountains are family, education, government, business, journalism and media, arts and entertainment, and religion. And you see there at the in their religion, the NAR is not just interested in conquering mountains such as government. They want to conquer the mountain of religion and so be the supreme religion over all others, including other Christian denominations and traditions. Now, followers of the NAR and the leaders are to pick a mountain and try to make their vision of Christianity dominate their chosen sphere or industry. There's now a proliferation of NAR leaders and organizations that are attempting to make the country a theocracy. City Elders, for example, a new organization based in Oklahoma, details plans to create guardians over politics, elections, and culture in every county in the country, and would essentially create a local shadow government over our education decisions, over our governmental decisions, over the decisions we make in our shared lives. NAR leaders are among the biggest backers of the move to the hard right that we are seeing in politics. Indeed, NAR leaders have been among the most faithful backers of Donald Trump, calling him, quote, God's chosen candidate, unquote, and have ties to the U.S. Speaker of House, Mike Johnson. They were also key organizers bringing groups to DC for the insurrection on January 6. On top of this, the NARC sees the world in stark binary terms, where all those who do not follow them are considered demonic or under demonic influence. They have particularly targeted politicians on the left with this rhetoric, as well as LGBTQ persons and trans persons in particular, not just dehumanizing people, but demonizing people. What is alarming is that these ideas are gaining a wider influence and are now being used by far-right politicians and organizations more broadly. As we see in the essay, NAR is deeply anti-democratic, both as a movement and in its visions of society. See Peter Wagner, who is the one who's actually came up with the term New Apostolic Reformation, has preached, quote, "What dominion means is that we are the head and not the tail of our society. It's a rulership, and we rule as kings," unquote.
We've been listening to researchers from the Southern Poverty Law Center discuss their annual report, The Year in Hate and Extremism 2023. We heard Margaret Wong, president and CEO of the SPLC, and from multiple senior research analysts, R.G. Cravens, Cassie Miller, and Joe Winnicke-Leiden. The report highlighted emerging trends in anti-government organizing that is particularly important as the 2024 election approaches. More details about the report can be found online at splcenter.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Ellen Clark, correspondent with Street Roots, about her latest article for the paper. It's called Pets Living Unhoused: Dogs and Humans Care for Each Other. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. So your newest article dives into the role that pets play for folks who are unhoused. What can you tell me about that relationship?
Well, the biggest thing about that is the emotional support. They really do keep people's mental health intact. I could see the dependence, and it goes both ways between the dog and the owner. But a couple of people actually said to me that their dogs have kept them from getting real depressed and even committing suicide or thinking about it. So I would say that the emotional support is the biggest part, and it can be kind of a stepping stone towards them moving forward with other parts of their lives. It makes it just that much easier for them to move on with possibly finding housing or a job.
For this article, you spoke to a few different folks in shelters and on the streets talking about their dogs. What were the common themes that you heard?
Well, the common themes, again, was the emotional support and stability that they provide. I did get to speak to people who are taking real good care of their pets. And so they spoke about that. For example, they will go and get food giveaways and free veterinary health with clinics that are available. They'll access those. But also even things like exercise, taking their dogs to an unleashed area to run around. One person said that he takes his two dogs out for a bike ride. He has them both on leashes and rides the bike, and they love it. So mostly I was hearing about the care that they provide and how much they depend on each other.
Well, yeah, that was going to be my next question. What all goes into caring for a dog while being unhoused?
Well, like I said, there are lots of food donations available. For example, Rose Haven and other nonprofits have dog food donations. And then people will line up at the drop-in clinic at the Paw Team. And that is where they can get their dog vaccinated, get microchipped, also things like medicine. For example, I saw one dog that had a rash, and they were able to get medicine for that. And then there are also clinics hosted at places like Blanche House, where people are already accessing other services, so it's easy for them to get there. And Oregon Humane Society has the community health hospital, where they can do neutering, and they also provide that at clinics. And there's a sliding scale.
I think a couple of the folks you spoke with also mentioned, along with this emotional support role, that dogs can be helpful for, you know, staying alert and feeling protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One person I talked to, Darlene, she mentioned if she's ever alone in the tent at night, her dog, who is a real affectionate dog that people pet all the time, but if it's nighttime and the dog is in the tent with her, he will bark at anybody that comes near. Nobody is going to steal their belongings or put her in a vulnerable position because she feels very protected by that dog. And I heard the same things from other people, that the dogs are kind of like a little alarm system. They will notice when somebody's not trustworthy, or they can sense danger and kind of let them know by their behavior.
Well, your story also makes mention of Oregon Senate Bill 496, which didn't make it out of committee this year in the legislature. What was that bill all about?
So that bill was all about providing grant money from the general fund for companion animals for homeless people. It didn't make it out of the Ways and Means Committee.
When you were speaking to folks, did you find that the pets that they were caring for were ever a barrier to them finding housing?
Well, I don't know about housing, but there's a limited amount of shelter space, and there's rules around having a dog in shelter space. For example, only one dog per person, which can be kind of hard if there's a family. And also having a dog kenneled, which a lot of people are not comfortable with. And so with the rules that are in place and the limited amount of space, I would say that that's a barrier. And people will choose to sleep outside because they don't want to be separated from their dog if they can't get into a shelter.
Of all the folks that you talked to, did you have a favorite story or a favorite animal that you met?
Okay, yes, I have to admit. There was a Rottweiler named Mamas that I met, and her owner, his name is Steve. They live in a tent together, and I could see that Steve has trained her. He held her real close on the leash, and she sat when he asked her to sit, and she's healthy looking. I went with her into the veterinary office at the Paw Team Clinic, and they gave her a microchip and gave him some supplies to take with him. It was real obvious to me that he takes good care of her. And she kind of takes care of him, too. She gives him a lot of mental stability, and he's feeling like he can move forward with trying to find housing for them. And she's real cute and real well-behaved. She weighs 85 pounds.
Were there aspects of reporting this story that you found surprising?
I guess overall, I was surprised that there are some services available, which I didn't know about before. I did not know about the Pod Team Clinic, and I was kind of amazed with how they set things up at places like Lanche House, where, you know, it's central and people can go. And also the dedication and commitment from people at the Oregon Humane Society, Pod Team Clinic, anywhere where they're helping dogs. I wouldn't say I was surprised by it, but it was wonderful to see that. One thing I noticed is these pets that I saw, they never leave their owner's side. You know, they're kept real close, and there seems to be a lot of trust between them and their owners, and they kind of watch out for them. For example, when I was at the Paw Team Clinic, there's a lot of people in line. It was pretty orderly for every person holding a dog with them. I thought it was pretty mellow. It went really well, smoothly.
I mean, in talking about this and talking to people, like you mentioned, who are doing this work, to your mind, are there misconceptions out there about the relationship between pets and their unhoused owners?
Yeah, I think there probably are, because you might think, well, how can they take care of a pet if they can barely take care of themselves? Well, a lot of times people will go without food or even without shelter to put the dog first. And that also takes place when somebody may need a hospital stay, but they don't have a boarding place. There's very few options for people who are homeless with overnight stays for pets. And so they will forego health care and put the pet first.
What do you hope that readers and listeners take away from your piece?
Well, I hope they'll realize that everybody, whether you're housed or unhoused, deserves to have a pet and can take good care of a pet. And I hope that people will think about donating to places that do help, because they just need to do more of what they're already doing. There's such a greater need than what they can provide with limited funding.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, I'd like to say hello to my family, Mike, Matthew, and Michaela, and a big shout out to our dog named Roscoe.
Shout out to Roscoe. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about this.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
That was Ellen Clark, correspondent with Street Roots, speaking with me about her article for the paper. It's called Pets Living Unhoused, Dogs and Humans Care for Each Other. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
On the web at kboo.fm.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone